Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Superhuman, Countdown to Apocalypse, by Evan Curry, narrated by Kevin T. Collins. Prologue. Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, People's Republic of China. Li Shen groaned quietly as he rolled over on the cold, hard surface beneath him, slowly opening his eyes and trying to remember how it was he'd come to where he now found himself. It was dark, and the air stank of something he couldn't place. There was fuel oil mixed with blood and a stench beyond both. His heart increased as he snapped awake, pushing himself off the ground. He almost hit the ceiling when his push somehow propelled him several feet straight up, arcing into a wall before he bounced off and hit the ground again with a thud.
"Ay-oh,"
Shen moaned, holding very still for a moment while he tried to combat the pain in his head.
"Who hit me with a truck?"
"If you find him," another voice said in similarly accented Cantonese,
"I command that you kill him for us both."
Shen rolled over onto his back, looking up at the open sky between the buildings that towered above him.
"Chi, is that you?"
"Who else would it be, idiot?" asked Xiao Qi, Shen's girlfriend, her voice irritated and in seemingly no mood for any sort of small talk. Shen was about to answer when another groan caught his attention, and he forced himself up again, slowly this time, and looked around.
"What in all the demons?"
He trailed off, eyes widening as he saw body after body laid out around him like so many slabs of wood fallen in the street. There were dozens, if not more than that. Most were still, but some were now stirring like he and Chi. He scrambled fully to his feet and backed up until he was pressed against the side of the building he'd bounced off earlier, eyes wide.
"Shen?"
Chi looked at him from where she was still lying on the floor.
"Are you all right?"
Shen shook his head. "Nothing is all right about this." He recognized some of the faces, clothing, and such as members of two of the largest triad gangs in the area. Worse, unless he was greatly mistaken, he was almost certain that he was looking at two of their leaders, men who shared only hatred for one another.
"This will not end well," Shen thought desperately as he looked around for a way out. "I need to grab Chi and get both of us out of here."
He lunged forward, grabbing her by the arm and pulling her to her feet.
"Come on."
"What is wrong with you, Shen?" she snapped, pulling back against him. He jerked her close, twisting her around to show her the scene behind her, clapping a hand across her mouth as she sucked in a breath to scream.
"We should go now," he said, hissing the words in her ear.
Chi nodded fearfully as the pair started to back away from the bodies that were even then beginning to stir and awaken. Su'an Yen grunted as he snapped to a sitting position almost instantly, eyes blazing as he looked around desperately without seeing.
"What in the nine hells was that?"
he snarled angrily, heart thudding in his ears. He felt like a man waking from a nightmare, but somehow he knew that wasn't so. He could remember the bodies of the dead pressing up against him, limbs and organs floating freely as something reached into his chest and... Yen shook his head, forcefully pushing the imagery out as he slowly climbed to his feet and looked around, this time with eyes that saw his surroundings rather than imagined memories. He recognized many members of his triad, the Commercial Guild of Shining Righteousness, as well as several key members of their key rivals, the 20,000. He instantly reached for his pistol, only to find it gone. As he looked for it in his clothing, Yen realized that he was wearing the tattered remnants of his $20,000 suit.
"Whoever ruined my clothing is going to die," he pledged through gritted teeth, "slowly and painfully." "You always were a vain, pretty boy, Yen." He spun on the voice, recognizing the leader of the 20,000 triad, who was now getting to his feet. "Luca," Yen spat. "If you had something to do with this..." "You'll what?" Shou-Ah Luca asked, rolling his eyes. "Kill me more than you already plan to? I'm not afraid of you, Yen, so spare me the mindless ravings about your pretty boy fashion sense and personal psychosis. Perhaps that's always been your problem. You should be," Yen shifted threateningly, hands balling up into fists. "You think to threaten me, pansy boy?" Luca laughed, lifting his hands to gesture in a come-and-get-me manner. "I'll kick your ass to the curb twice, then do the same to your whole damn gang." Yen's heart was hammering in his chest, the sound of it drowning out everything else around him as he felt himself roar and lunge. The speed of his strike surprised him just as much as it appeared to shock Luca, who barely managed to get his arms up in defense. It didn't matter, though, too little, too late. The blows struck through the weak defense, and Yen's fist struck low in Luca's chest, lifting him clear off the ground and sending him flying back across the street they were in until he slammed into a building. The cement of the old tenement cracked, and the building visibly shuddered under the impact as dust and chips rained down from above. For a moment, no one moved. The shock on all faces was evident, none more so than Yen's own. That shock was only multiplied, however, when the body of Luca shifted and moved, and the triad leader pried himself out of the indentation he'd made when he struck the building. Luca dropped a few feet to the ground, looking back at the damage with surprise on his own face, and then down at one of the chunks of cement that had fallen when he broke himself loose. He knelt down, picking up the material, and turned it over in his hands as he marveled at just how good he felt. Luca closed his fist, turning the cement to powder as a manic grin spread across his face, and he looked up sharply to where his rival was standing, staring. "This is an interesting development," he said simply, right before launching himself across the darkened street. At Yen. Shen's eyes widened, and he would have been hard-pressed to say whether it was more in shock or horror as he watched the two gang leaders tear into one another with a fury normally reserved for the cinemas. Granted, none of them were as skilled as the action heroes in the local cinema, but they made up for it in sheer power and ferocity. The air visibly shook as they rained blow after blow upon one another, making the whole scene like a surreal moment out of time from what he could tell.
What is happening?" Chi asked, her voice stunned. "I do not know. I hope I am dreaming," he answered, "because if this is real, no nightmare could be worse."
Chi nodded beside him as the pair shrank more into the shadows, desperately trying not to be noticed. They weren't the only ones. Many of those others in the street who had awakened, or been awakened by the fighting, were scrambling to get clear of Ground Zero. Some just kept running as best he could tell, ducking into an alley and vanishing into the night. Others were making a circle and already starting to cheer on one or the other of the combatants.
"How strange," Shen thought. "I would have expected them to remain surprised a little longer than that."
Apparently, loyalty to their leaders was overriding the natural fear and wonder that had to be in their little brains somewhere. The members of the triad gangs were giving both combatants a fair distance, but Shen didn't think the distance between them and Chi was nearly enough.
"Come on," he urged Chi. "We have to go."
She nodded numbly, allowing herself to be pulled along as the fighting only intensified. Then a blast of sound and shock swept over them, and Shen felt Qi suddenly yank back against his grip as he turned.
Yen planted himself and defended against the flurry of Luca's counterattack, both shocked and enthused by the strength he felt running through himself, though dismayed that he was seeing similar in his rival. He could tell that the blows were fierce, with a force unlike anything he'd ever experienced, but they felt little more than normal to him as he parried the strikes with counters of his own. When an opening presented itself, he struck back, delivering a cross to Luca's chin and rocking the other man around jarringly. Luca recovered quickly, however, and returned the favor in kind. Yen was staggered, stumbling away from the blow as he felt dazed by the force, but only that. He spun back, swinging with a wild punch that Luca ducked under and felt a jab into his gut lift him off the ground. Yen grunted, but he recovered and swung down as he returned to the ground and tagged Luca hard as the other man was drawing back from being overextended. Luca was driven down to the ground, but roared and drove up from his knees to hammer his shoulder into Yen's midsection, lifting him off the ground and charging across the street into the side of a building. The old skyscraper shook from the blow, and lights came on all up and down the street as their fight finally attracted attention as something to be bothered getting up for. Yen hammered his fists down into Luca's back, swearing profanities to the skies as he did so, even as Luca reared back and hammered him into the building again. A chunk of cement fell, and Yen reached out to pluck it from the air as if in slow motion and with vicious speed slammed it down into the back of Luca's head. The other triad leader slumped from the blow, giving Yen the opening to bring his knee up and hammer Luca in the face. The force of that strike lifted Luca into the air, and Yen moved like lightning to finish his enemy. Yen struck again, hitting Luca in midair with enough force to send the other man flying across the now badly damaged street, slamming him into the corner of a building with enough force to blow through the cement and send shrapnel flying in all directions. Yen, focused on his fallen foe, brushed himself off as he stalked forward.
"Anyone still professing loyalty to that piece of a turd dies here tonight."
He looked at the fearful eyes of his enemies and the near worship of his own people and exulted in the moment. A howl of pure rage put an end to it an instant later, however.
"Qi! Qi!"
Shen sucked in a desperate breath as he realized she had fallen to the ground. Shen dropped to his knees at her side, noting the blood streaming from her head as he clutched at her.
"Speak to me, Qi," he demanded, getting no reaction.
Shen felt the blood roaring in his veins, each beat of his heart drowning out all else as they melded together into a single roaring rush of blood. His eyes blazed as he snapped his head up and saw the arrogant bastard smirking as he walked down the street amid throngs of his troops. The same bastard who was responsible for Qi lying there on the ground. Shen howled. It was no sound of sadness, but one of pure and unadulterated rage. He didn't even notice as he rose to his feet and turned to face the gathered triad members, who were all beginning to turn in his direction. Shen just saw the looks of shock on their faces, not the blaze of fire that was shimmering into existence right behind him. Heat was pouring off the amorphous form, enough to be felt quite some distance away, but it meant nothing to him as he roared his rage uncontrollably at the bastards who had hurt Qi. A dragon of flame and spirit rose up behind him and echoed his roar with a noise that shook the city for blocks around. The last thing Shen remembered seeing was the triad foot soldiers and their leader scattering as the blazing figure swept past him and began its rampage down the alley and into the street beyond. USS Ronald Reagan, CVN 76, South China Sea,
Captain on deck.
As you were, Captain Matthew Matt Hallows said, as he stepped onto the command deck of the Gipper's Island. The watch crew were setting about their business in the pre-dawn light of the South China Sea, the entire task group having been on alert for the last day and a half. No one was really sure what it was all about just yet, of course, but Matt had a good idea that it had to do with China, judging from their deployment orders, though, given how the news was exploding about the events in Houston, he supposed it might be linked to that, too.
Orders from SOCOM, sir. Presidential authorization.
Thank you, XO, Matt said, accepting the printout from his executive officer, Captain David Burke. He read through it quickly, noting that it was advising him of the imminent arrival of a SOCOM asset.
Do we have any inbound flights?
Nothing scheduled, nothing on radar, David responded simply. I've had the group running sweeps looking for them. Requests to SOCOM for more details have been ignored.
Matt nodded, not entirely surprised. SOCOM, Special Operations Command, could be vague and cagey bastards at the best of times. Still, they wouldn't generally try and drop something like this on a carrier group without reasonable warning.
Continue sweeps, Matt ordered. Be sure I'm advised as soon as the SOCOM asset makes contact. Hopefully, he'll know what the hell is going on.
Aye, Skipper, David replied simply before he left to relay the orders.
Matt didn't much like any of what was going on, but that wasn't a requirement of the job, he supposed. He walked over to the hatch and stepped out of the command deck onto the walkway, where he could look out over the flight deck as operations were underway. The slight gradient of the sky showed that they were just into astronomical dawn. The sun wouldn't be up for a while yet, but its light was filtering over the horizon just enough that it was no longer technically night. Matt looked out over the black sea rolling around them, eyes spotting the lights of the Ticonderoga cruisers and Arleigh Burke destroyers running the picket around the Gipper's position. He knew that there was a pair of attack submarines in close as well, two more running point along their course, and a final two taking up the rear. Combined with the projection power of the Reagan herself, there were few things on the planet with the power to match a Nimitz carrier task force.
Captain, David called softly, though his tone had an urgent hint to it as he leaned out the hatch. We have something.
Matt pushed off the rail and headed back in.
What is it?
Unknown contact, David said, closing fast. We couldn't pick it up. The Shiloh reported it. We have a repeater of their screens up here. It's strange, Skipper.
Let's see it, Matt frowned.
David Burke was a carrier-qualified pilot and matched his own skills entirely, which meant that he'd have seen damn near everything there was to see over his years of service. For him to call something strange in these circumstances was, in itself, strange. Matt leaned over the screen, eyes narrowing as he examined the contact. It was small, really small. If not for the speed, he'd have written it off as a bird.
Strange indeed, Matt said.
Is it a missile? Too small for ship-to-ship, or even air-to-surface, the radarman answered, having already ruled that out. It might be air-to-air, but we're not showing any sign of targeting across the spectrum.
Let's not take chances. Sound general quarters. Signal potential incoming, Matt ordered.
Aye, Skipper. General quarters.
A siren wound up across the carrier deck, and in the distance, Matt knew that others would be following through the entire task group. The contact was too close, he decided, already within their outer perimeter.
Get me a target lock on that contact, he ordered, and put some sea whiz on it.
Aye, Skipper.
The orders were relayed, and the Shiloh shifted course to intercept the target with their sea whiz radar-controlled guns. Matt read off the headings and contact information before grabbing a pair of NVDs and scanning the sky for any sign of whatever the hell was incoming.
Through the green tint of the night vision device, the scene lit up significantly, but he couldn't see any sign of a rocket or jet trail in the sky.
Shiloh is in position. Interception in 80 seconds and counting, Skipper.
Weapons free, Matt ordered. Challenge the contact on open channels. Warn it off.
Aye, Skipper, the radio man said instantly, speaking in urgent but low tones into his mic.
Unidentified contact, you are approaching controlled airspace. Turn away. I say again, turn away or you will be fired upon.
He waited briefly, then repeated himself and waited a few more seconds before shaking his head.
No response, Skipper.
Signal the Shiloh, Matt ordered.
Splash the contact.
USS Shiloh.
Weapons free, Captain Andrew Hero ordered tersely.
Weapons free, the weapons control officer responded. Track up and live.
The contact was moving fast, approaching from about 1,000 feet off the deck at nearly Mach 1. That ruled out wildlife, even though the contact looked like a particularly large bird, or perhaps a small flock. But nothing living moved that fast.
Skipper, orders from the Gipper, the communications officer said. They say splash the contact, sir.
All right, you heard them. Lock 'em up and burn 'em down, Hero ordered firmly, though a little unhappily.
He wasn't unhappy with the orders, of course. He was unhappy that they were relying on the Close-In Weapons System, CIWS, commonly pronounced CWIS. The contact was so small and fast that by the time they registered it and made the determinations, it was already inside the outer defense perimeter. CWIS was supposed to be the final line of defense, not the first. Outside the bridge, the radar-controlled 20mm M61 Vulcan cannon swung into operation, tracking the approaching target, leading it just enough as the rotary barrels began to spin up. The cannon spat fire at 4,500 rounds per minute, emptying its magazine in about 10 seconds. In that 10 seconds, total chaos erupted on the bridge of the Shiloh.
"Where'd it go?" Hero demanded as he watched the contact suddenly dip and accelerate, vanishing off their screen.
"It's on the deck. Just broke Mach. Still accelerating, Skipper.
Get it locked in with the second CWIS," Hero ordered automatically.
"Trying, but it's so low that the pitch of the ship is putting it below the CWIS's operational capability," the weapons control officer answered instantly as he worked.
"Damn it," Hero swore, looking out the windscreens. "Someone get me eyes on that target."
Men scrambled, bolting across the deck of the USS Shiloh as they scanned the sea for any sign of the missing target.
"There!" someone shouted, as lights shining from the task force illuminated something white in the air.
Rifles and machine guns were swung to cover it, but in moments they realized they were aiming at a rooster tail of water left in the wake of the contact rather than the contact itself.
"I see it!" another man yelled as he half-leaned over the rail that kept him from falling into the waters below, aiming his M4 at a blur that flashed by faster than he could follow.
Water erupted up out of the sea to fill the vacuum he left behind just as the sonic boom swept over the deck of the Shiloh.
"What the hell was that?"
someone else called, disbelief in his voice. There had been no sign of rocket thrust or jets, just a blur flashing through the air, barely above the surface of the waves. On the command deck, Hero swore, "Contact the Gipper. The contact got past us."
USS Ronald Reagan.
Floodlights swept every inch of the seas around the carrier as the sirens wailed across the deck. The news that the contact had made it past the inner security zone put every person on the big ship on edge, and eyes were searching everywhere for any sign of the attack that seemed imminent. One of the lights swept past an object in the air and then quickly reversed as alarms were raised and people yelled. Men rushed out across the flight deck with M4 carbines as the lights caught the target and stayed pinned to it as it slowly approached the ship.
The men-at-arms circled around as they established a kill zone that encompassed the target, but by that point none of them were thinking about their rifles nearly as much as they were wondering who was putting them on. The object in the air, pinned by three floodlights, was a man in desert Marpat camouflage drifting slowly toward the deck. He alighted easily, hands out to his side and visible until everyone seemed to be calming down. Then he slowly settled his hands behind his back, dropping into a textbook parade rest, and calmly waited for someone to approach.
"Identify yourself," the chief snapped, stepping a little closer but not dropping his weapon.
"That was some welcome. I was under the impression that you were informed I was coming, but I'm guessing they left out some details," the man said calmly. "Hail, Alexander Corwin, formerly Captain, United States Marine Corps. Now I suppose I'm an errand boy for SOCOM. They tell me it's a step up in the world. Honestly, I don't see it."
Chapter 1. Fort Hood, Texas. Colonel Emily Pearson was not a particularly happy camper. In the last week or so since the Houston incident, she'd been at the forefront of those trying to figure out what the hell had happened to cause the sudden development of, well, to be frank, superpowers among a significant number of Texas's less than sterling citizens, as well as a few of her best. With the help of Alex Hale, as well as a pair of civilians who'd been similarly affected, and the Houston PD, they'd managed to recapture some of the bikers who'd escaped the Supermax lockup at Estelle County. A few had confirmed alterations that were active, the rest had the CRISPR genetic engineering signs, but had not shown any active traits up to this point. That made holding the prisoners a stupidly difficult task, since some of them literally had powers once attributed to gods on Earth, and the others might awaken such at any time. She'd ordered two of the powered individuals to be put into medically induced comas, fighting to keep them from being executed simply because she needed access to their DNA in an ongoing manner for study. Otherwise, there was no chance of understanding any of this mess. Emily hoped that someone would work out a solution, but short of reopening Alcatraz or something similar, she didn't have a clue what could be done. Of course, given what we've seen with Hale, even that might not be enough. Over the last few days, it had become clear that the escaped bikers had scattered, at least in part, and were causing trouble in various places, spreading out from central Texas and into neighboring states. Rumors had some south of the border as well, but nothing was confirmed. The president had declared it a state of emergency, with the consent of the governor of Texas, which freed up National Guard and military units to respond if needed, but things were getting ugly all the same. If not for those two rangers, it would be a lot worse. Wood and Sanchez, two Texas rangers who'd been caught up in the incident, the same as Hale and his buddies, had been altered as well. She didn't know how to describe their abilities, beyond insane, but they'd quickly settled into running from reported incident to reported incident and hunting down the escapees with dogged determination. They'd already delivered 5 to her and eliminated another 8 that wouldn't surrender. Texas and the surrounding states are turning into a reenactment of some insane Hollywood imagining of the Wild Wild West. The only bright side is that we've got a pair of rangers on the job who are actually filling the role. And now, this incident in Hong Kong. That was what, of course, was taking the current highest priority, and why she was joining the National Command Authority on a conference call in just a few seconds. Emily shuddered. She'd rather be dealing with the lunatics with superpowers. The call went through, however, and she straightened slightly in her chair as the screens in front of her lit up.
"Welcome, Colonel Pearson," the Secretary of Defense said from one of them. "Our resident expert on the..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?